I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching New Order, broadcasting all around the world, including to nearly 1.5 billion on RT India. We on New Order will trace how India and its allies sit at the center of a transformation in world history. The global order isn't collapsing, it's being rewritten. And this week, several chapters changed at once. The UAE quit OPEC, a unilateral exit effective May the 1st. The cartel that has impacted the price of oil for half a century is fracturing, and the country that just walked out of it is the same country that Prime Minister Modi is flying to in about a week's time on his way to Europe. Modi will focus on energy security and its regional and the regional situation following National Security Advisor Doval days ago and Jaishankar the week before. Abu Dhabi is now arguably the most diplomatically trafficked city on earth. Meanwhile, Kyrgyzstan hosts Indian Defense Minister Rajnath Singh and his Chinese, Russian, Iranian and Pakistani counterparts at Shanghai cooperation meetings that signal new cooperation far away from NATO nation attempts to dominate Eurasia. In a world where the old mechanisms are breaking down, where OPEC can be walked out of, where the Strait of Hormuz can be closed, where a ceasefire between a superpower and a theocracy gets brokered in Islamabad, the question is no longer who leads the world, it's who stays in the room with everyone at once. At the end of the show, we'll be joined by New Order Zara Khan, who will be with us to get questions from you, the viewers, and we'll try and answer as many of your questions as we can at the end of each show. With me today is the man who spent decades in the engine room of American foreign policy. He served as United States Ambassador to the United Nations, as National Security Advisor to President Trump in his first term, and as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He joins me now from Washington, D.C. Ambassador John Bolton, thanks so much for coming on New Order. Before we get to what you've called the most consequential decision of Trump's presidency, I have to ask a quick question, your reaction to the Comey, ex-head of the FBI, being indicted for trying to assassinate Trump. Ridiculous or fair revenge for his Russia hoaxing?
Well, you know, I think it is retribution. We'll see what they can actually make of the case. I think Comey said in his response he expects more coming too. And part of the retribution is just making people go through the process, paying attorneys' fees and doing all that. So we'll see how it turns out. It's a creative legal theory, let's put it that way.
I mean, do you think, I mean, your first indictment was anyway dismissed? I know the next trial is on completely different grounds. Do you think the DOJ is weaponized? Do you think you're a kind of Julian Assange figure almost? I mean, the next trial is
not.
Well, the next trial is more like that, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to get into specifics, but sure. I do think retribution is part of the Trump agenda. I said that in the foreword to my book, the new edition of the book that came out in January of 2024. And I think it's a mistake whether either party does it. I don't like to see it ratcheted up. There was some of it in the Biden administration. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, it's the characteristic of an authoritarian society is the former head of the NKVD, the Soviet Union's great spy network, as Lavrenty Beria once said to Stalin, "You show me the man, and I'll show you the crime." And that's not the way a rule of law society should function.
Well, of course, there is arguably an oblique reference to what's happening now in this region with the war on Iran. Millions killed, wounded, or displaced, mainly displaced, of course. You've intimated, I see, that you believe the war in Iran may nearly be over.
Well, I don't think it's over because I don't think we've done the necessary work to solve the problem in the way I think it has to be solved, which is through regime change. I think there were a lot of things that needed to be done that haven't been. It's not too late to do them, but it's not clear to me at this point that Trump really knows what his objective is. And of course, that makes it a lot harder to figure out how to achieve your objectives if you're not sure what they are.
So, I mean, what do you mean regime change? I mean, you'd back ground forces going in. Of course, they may have already gone in by the time this interview is being broadcast.
No, I don't think it's necessary. I think if you look at Iran with a sophisticated, well-educated population, this regime was in trouble long before the war started. For years, its economy has been in desperate straits. That's what the people were demonstrating about all over Iran in December and January before the government massacred upwards of 40,000.
The economic situation isn't demonstrating necessarily for a complete change of regime. I mean, Intel.
Well, I think the people understand. Yeah, I think the people understand that the regime is the problem. You know, not only is the economy bad, they're running out of water. The irrigation policies of the government to develop what they consider what the Ayatollah Khomeini, the original supreme leader, wanted, which was complete agricultural autonomy, has devastated the groundwater. I mean, they're even talking about having to move the capital out of Tehran. That's how bad it is.
Yeah, but I mean, so the economic had polluted water. That's not a reason for changing the regime in the United States. I mean, do you? Yeah. Well, who is telling you?
Let me tell you, the people.
Where are you getting this information from?
From people who know the situation inside Iran. There wouldn't have been the demonstrations on the economy have gone on since 2018, almost annually, as the situation has continued to deteriorate. But there are other causes of dissatisfaction. You know, young people under 30 comprise 70% of the Iranian population. They know they could have a different way of life. They can see it on the internet when the government allows the internet to function. They can see it across the Gulf in places like Doha and Dubai. So the young people are dissatisfied. The women, for over 3 years now, since the murder of Mahsa Amini, the young Kurdish woman who was killed by the besieged militia for violating the Ayatollah's dress code, the women have fundamentally challenged the basic legitimacy of the Ayatollahs themselves, who say, you know, they speak with the word of God, and the women say, not on the dress code. And it's not just about what they wear. That says
the Iranian government said that was no, that case has completely been hijacked by those supporting, I don't know, the Shah. You don't believe that the country blames the United States?
Let me just tell you, when 50%,
you don't believe they blame the United States?
50% of the population. 50% of the population don't like what happened to Mahsa Amini. And when 50%, meaning the women, turn against you, that's a serious problem. You know, there are grandmothers in Iran who remember what life was like before 1979. And the reality is, it's not just about social mores, it's about the legitimacy of the regime itself. Because if the Ayatollahs don't speak the word of God on the dress code, they don't speak the word of God on anything. And then finally, just so your listeners are completely filled in, ethnic groups in Iran are significantly dissatisfied, Kurds, Azeris, Baluchis, and others. So the regime is at, I think, the weakest point it's ever been since it took power in 1979.
I mean, I should say I lived in Iran. I didn't really see any of this. And I've got to say, surely they would blame the sanctions as the reason for the economic problems. And the sanctions come from Washington. And as regards economic problems, no one in the world was saying that the United States regime needed to be overthrown because Occupy Wall Street was on the front pages of headlines all over the world. You don't think they're going to blame the sanctions?
Oh, Occupy Wall Street amounts to about 1/1000th of 1% of the American public opinion. I think in Iran, if it were possible to take a really free and fair public opinion analysis, it'd be 75% to 80% of the people opposed to the regime. And those supporting it were largely those who depended on the regime, the bureaucracy, the Revolutionary Guard, and the military. This is really, I think, and we've had other developments because of the war that show that the Gulf Arab states who tried to appease Iran, I mean, they tried to find a way to allow Iran to do what it was doing as long as they didn't challenge them directly. I think the Iranian attacks on the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, not on U.S. bases, not on Israel, but on civilian targets in the Gulf Arab states have fundamentally changed attitudes there as well, making the regime in Tehran even more of a pariah than it was before the war began.
Yes, certainly there are complications in the GCC for those attacks. But you don't believe that given Donald Trump's lack of popularity, that even Donald Trump would be supported by a majority of Americans if the United States was being bombarded. You just don't, I mean, you're a former national security advisor. You would never advise a president that bombing another country leads to a rally around the flag mentality within that country?
Oh, I tell you, the people in Iran today, by and large, understand that the targets that we've gone after, first the air defenses, then the instruments of state power that repress the people, like the Revolutionary Guard, like its besieged militia, like the Quds force that threatens its neighbors, the military infrastructure, the military production, they can see that these attacks are discriminate and that they're not aimed against the Iranian
people. Telling you this? Because all the Iranians, that's what's interesting.
Let's look at a little history here.
It's an intel situation, isn't it? You're hearing from some Iranians, others are hearing from other Iranians. It's a country of 90 million people. We know from prior interventions after 9/11 that again and again, the consequences of U.S. actions have not led to what the intelligence led the perpetrators.
And this is not from intelligence. This is from people talking to people inside Iran. And I think history is important to look here. I mean, under the theory that bombing always turns the inhabitants of a country against those doing the bombing, that would imply that the German and Japanese populations have hated America since 1945. And in fact, we can see the exact opposite, because the people understood under the Nazi regime in Germany and under the imperial government in Japan, it was the people who were the victims of the government, and that the destruction of those governments was for their benefit. And the same is true in the case of Iran.
I knew you'd go to the Nazis that quickly. Look, clearly in this region, there are still conversations being had, the UAE, with Iranian counterparts. India is still talking to Iran. Iran doesn't see itself as isolated at all since this war began. Why do you believe Trump did this? Was it Miriam Adelson? Why did he do this?
Well, let's go back to the UAE for a minute. I mean, I think there are significant events that are occurring here. I think the withdrawal of the UAE from OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, won't have a direct effect on the war, but it's a sea change in the region. And I think will allow the UAE to draw closer to Israel. And I think it will also result in lower prices of oil as the UAE and others pump more when they're not constrained by OPEC quotas. Look, yeah, it's true that Iran is close to Russia and China. That's not a recommendation. That's a problem because the Russia-China axis, I should say the China-Russia axis, because China is clearly the dominant partner, unlike the Sino-Soviet alliance of the Cold War, that is a threat not just in Europe and Ukraine, not just to Taiwan, across the strait from China, but really all along the China-Russia periphery. So it's something that when you see an outrider like Iran that's really buttressed by China and Russia, that should be something that does concern people.
Yeah, well, it wasn't so much Russia and China, the big bugbears of U.S. foreign policy wonks. It's the entire global south, isn't it, that clearly the United States is the aggressor.
I don't see it at all.
Making deals with Iran.
Look, the issue here is the oil that you can get from countries in the region. So I think the answer here is we continue to blockade Iranian oil, but open the Strait of Hormuz so that the Gulf Arab states can export oil. And as for the Philippines, they look at the South China Sea. They see China building airstrips and naval bases on rocks and reefs that are about a quarter of an inch above the water on a good day. They see the threat of China. That's why they're growing closer to the United States, not farther away from it.
Ambassador, we'll continue after the break. Keep watching New Order. You're watching New Order. Ambassador John Bolton. Well, you mentioned OPEC, of course, in part one. What do you think that decision actually means? Do you think it's oversold in the United States media that this signals immediately that the UAE is going to somehow do America's bidding at the expense of a more unified Arab world? Or do you see it as the UAE forging alliances within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS? Of course, the UAE and Iran, the newest members of BRICS.
Yeah, look, I think the UAE is showing its growth and maturation. I think all cartels eventually break down, and in many respects, I think it'll benefit the Saudis in the long term as well. But the point is, that just shows that even momentary coalescences like that ultimately don't survive. But I think it's really a problem more for Iran, because as alternative sources of oil, finance, and other things open up, Iran just becomes less necessary. I mean, one thing that the UAE did very early in the war is cut off Iran's use of Dubai's financial institutions to launder its money out into the international banking system. So it's another major blow for the Iranian regime.
Although there have been conversations between the UAE and Iran, but in that respect, I mean, you appear to say that although Trump doesn't have objectives, which you'd like outlined, you more or less applaud his war, and you smiled when I said it was at the behest of Miriam Adelson. Why does he need to announce the objectives if the actual process is one that you actually support?
Well, I don't support the way he's gone about it. I think he failed to make the case to the American people, which is a very compelling case about why regime change in Iran is necessary. He didn't make the case to Congress. He didn't brief our allies and friends, not just NATO. He didn't brief the Gulf Arabs. He didn't brief countries in the Indo-Pacific, allies and friends alike, like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia.
You were at Colorado University the other day with Susan Rice, who I should say is a controversial character in her own right. I'd love to have seen that debate. And you said there's never been a rule-based international order. Why do you suddenly want Trump to be wandering around getting the okay from all these different countries? You said it doesn't matter.
Not getting the okay. I learned a lot of what I know about diplomacy under George H.W. Bush. He did assemble an international coalition to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. It worked. I think the same was possible here, not necessarily using boots on the ground, but helping the Iranian opposition that need resources. They need telecommunications equipment. They need money. They need weapons so that they can stand up against the besieged militia, who, by the way, with our blockade in place, are now soon not going to be paid, and they're going to be very unhappy with the regime. There's more to come here. This regime, I think, is fracturing at the top, and every reason to think if we could keep up the pressure that eventually it would fall.
Can you give me two sides to this? If your intelligence is completely wrong, which I think a lot of the world sees it as, they're very strong, that regime, and they're all coming around and rallying around the flag, how would you advise the Iranian government as it stands now? I know you're going to say the Iranian government is very disparate and disassociated and localized. So if your intelligence is correct and it's on its last legs, how would you advise the government? And if it's not, and it's getting stronger, and as I say, Araghchi was in Moscow recently, Chinese, Indian, Russian, Pakistan defense ministers have been in Kyrgyzstan for Shanghai Cooperation meetings. Where I sit here in Dubai, it looks like Iran is in communication with all the countries in this region. How would you advise the Iranian government?
Well, I think Foreign Minister Araghchi is probably in Moscow checking out the apartments where he might live in exile after the regime falls. I think that there are many people inside the regime that the opposition can contact who can see the regime can't defend itself. And ultimately, if it can't defend itself, it's not going to survive.
It can defend itself with the Strait of Hormuz. It has a something as powerful as a nuclear weapon.
I think we can break their control. I think we can break their control on the Strait of Hormuz. We should have been doing it earlier. I'm not sure why we didn't, but we should have. I think you're going to get defections from the regime. I think this is, as it crumbles from the inside, it could collapse quickly. But we need to do more to help the opponents, who are really the overwhelming majority of the population of Iran.
How regarding the Strait of Hormuz? How can you open the Strait of Hormuz?
Look, I think we can clear the mines very quickly. I hope that we're actually doing that now. The real threat is the anti-ship missiles provided to Iran by China and the swarms of fast boats and drones that they can throw against convoys of tankers. But we have ways of dealing with that too. And I think
we should resume.
Well, you finished destroying the missiles, the missile launchers, the drones. We've already destroyed their production facilities. They're not making any new drones, missiles, or mines in Iran because they've been destroyed. And in the first wave of attacks, we've eliminated most of their capacity. Some say there's perhaps 25% more to destroy. So I say, fine, let's get on with it.
That's not what is being said at all in this region. They have massive underground installations of these missiles, and their manufacturing is going full speed ahead.
Well, that may be what the Iranian government says, but they'd be wrong on that. And it shows how they treat the people of Iran. Like the Hamas fortresses, tunnels under the Gaza Strip, while the people were in dire economic straits on top of it, the people of Iran have been neglected by the Revolutionary Guard and the government to help entrench themselves in power. So they've been at it for 47 years to build this super deep state. We've been after them for 6 weeks. I think we're making good progress. It takes 47 years by a long shot.
Comparison then, Gaza's still there, despite what's happened and the onslaught of... I mean, isn't there another element to this, which is Iran hasn't even started to launch Khorram Shah missiles at Israeli targets? So it's using the Strait of Hormuz as its weapon at the moment.
Look, they've launched the best they've got, and they've caused minimal damage. What they have done is alienate the Gulf Arab states who have been trying to appease them during the past several years, a critical mistake by the regime in Tehran.
So you believe that it is possible right now to win the war on Iran. Do you believe Trump is going to take your advice and try and rectify what is seen as mistakes? Or is he not going to do that, in which case the outcome will be just another defeat after Afghanistan, Libya, I don't know, all the way back to Vietnam?
I don't call those defeats. I call Afghanistan a mistaken withdrawal. I think if Trump did what I suggested in order to achieve regime change, he would succeed. But I have no idea what he's actually going to do.
Did you put a plan on the table when you were National Security Advisor?
I urge that our objective be regime change. That's correct. By the way, so did Bibi Netanyahu. Bibi's been saying the same thing in the first term and in the second term. So there's no change in what Trump has been hearing from him. I don't know what caused Trump to launch this attack, but it wasn't Bibi Netanyahu, that's for sure.
Did you believe Blinken when he said, look how strong the Biden administration was in saying no to Netanyahu?
Look, the Biden administration, I think, missed a lot of opportunities, and they spent 4 years trying to get another nuclear deal with Iraqi and his predecessors. And I think that just gave the regime more time to dig in and build those large underground storage facilities for the Shahed drones.
And so your plan to Trump when you were National Security Advisor included the important context of the Strait of Hormuz, which appears to have taken some people by surprise in Washington.
Well, I can tell you in the first term, all of the potential contingencies were discussed, and anybody who's ever looked at a map knows the Strait of Hormuz is a potential choke point, and that the likelihood of the regime in Iran attacking the Gulf Arabs had to be taken into account. If Trump didn't see that, I can't explain that.
So why did Trump say he was surprised?
Maybe he wasn't paying attention. It wouldn't be the first time.
He was reading your national security advice, presumably.
Pardon me?
He was reading your national security advice about your version of the war in Iran.
Well, he didn't follow it if he was reading it.
And is it your understanding that there are now elements of dissent, J.D. Vance, Tulsi Gabbard, there are spaces there in the cabinet who are now arguing for an early exit, an off-ramp, as it's called in the mainstream media?
Yeah, I think there are isolationists in the administration who are arguing that point. I'm going to have to go here in a minute. We've gone a little bit longer than I anticipated. Not that I didn't enjoy every minute, but I do have to go here.
Ambassador John Bolton, thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And now I'm joined by Zahra Khan with some of your questions. Zahra, Ambassador Bolton there, who would have known he told Trump to invade Iran even before this present invasion that's affected billions around the world, all the people in India, all the people in the global south?
See, that's why it's great for viewers who are watching New Order. We always get insights like that and questions.
Tragic ones.
Questions that we have And something that's already come up in your conversation with James Rickards in the past, Anton Morik has asked, why is BRICS having so much trouble coming with a hard asset, resource-based currency?
Clearly, there's obviously gold, but that, as we've said in previous New Order editions, India would win too much, wouldn't it, out of it? Because perhaps the Chinese, the Russians, the Brazilians, and the South Africans realize that that would mean India would win. Should they pursue the BRICS currency? Clearly, there is an urgency for it, and they should have really pushed for it in the sanctions, in the fallout of the sanctions regime after Russia's eventual response to NATO provocation in Ukraine.
And Lily Chan, continuing on the BRICS, has asked, if they can't even agree during a crisis, can they really reshape the world order?
That is a good question. There are lots of people that are asking that question who are on the side of BRICS. And of course, lots of those on the asking that question on the side of those opposed to BRICS. It is in the interests of NATO powers to destroy BRICS. Trump has avowedly said it. He's always been transparent about the motives of United States empire and hegemony. Clearly, it's not looking as good as it should look, given the crisis in NATO hegemony right now. Can they do this before the war in Iran destroys global South economies and economic prospects for billions of the poor all around the world? That's the big question. It's all going to hinge on Delhi, really.
Thank you for your answers, Afshin. Unfortunately, we're all out of time, but we'll pick this up again next week.
Thanks, Sarah. And that's it from me, Afshin Ratansi, on New Order. Remember to follow us on social media. And here's a question for you. Will the U.S. war in Iran rank as a bigger disaster than the neocon wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Send us your answer on X at @NewOrder_TV. Join us every Sunday as we continue to track shifting global power and where India sits in this New Order.